You want me to read my introduction about myself?
Yeah.
Well, good evening, everybody. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Craig Remora. Thanks for everybody being here tonight. I know John just went to the Lord, but I'd like to start with him, too. Well, Lord, thanks for joining us tonight. You tell us where two or three come together in your name. You're here with us. So I just ask that you you speak through me and speak to the people that are here and what you want them to hear. So I just thank you and praise you in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Well, tonight, guys, I'm just going to kind of talk a little bit about my life. My topic tonight is perspective. First of all, can everybody hear me okay? My topic is perspective. And so I just thought I'd read the definition of perspective. It's a particular attitude toward or way of regarding something or a point of view. So I'm going to be 61 years old next month. And for everybody in here, some older than me, some younger than me, as we go through our lives, you know, we develop perspective. And so tonight I'm just going to talk a little bit about where I grew up, how I grew up, and some of the things that affected my perspective, I would say, the first 30 years of my life. So I grew up in a little town in Weirton, West Virginia. Just to give you a geographical perspective of where that is, it's in the northern panhandle of West Virginia. As the crow flies from my house, it was about a mile to Ohio, right on the other side of the Ohio River, and probably 5 miles the other direction, it was Pennsylvania. And my mom's still alive, and so when I fly to visit my mom in Weirton, I fly into to the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania airport, and it takes me 25 minutes to get to my house. So I'm 30 miles from downtown Pittsburgh, 2 hours from Columbus, Ohio. So I was just going to talk a little bit about growing up in Weirton, being born in 57. This is really it's steel town. It's a big boom town because steel is king in the 50s and 60s and the 70s when I'm born and growing up. My dad, his name was Mike. Everyone called him Mitch. He passed away last year at the age of 89 years old. He lived a good long life. I would say that, well, most of his life he spent in law enforcement, mostly being a policeman in Weirton. He was also a county sheriff, and then toward the end of his working career, he worked in Weirton Steel. My mom, she worked as a telephone operator in her early work years, and then most of her life she worked as a hospital administrator. Her name is Jen. She's still alive. She's 88 years old, and she still lives in Weirton. And I have a sister named Lynn, who is 3 years younger than me, and she currently lives in Denver, Colorado. So, growing up in my house, you know, I've been on this earth for 60 years, and I've heard a lot of bad stories about how men and women grew up, but I was really fortunate and blessed growing up in my house. My dad was clearly the leader of our house. He was a really tough guy. His mom and dad died when he was 16 and 17 years old, back to back. So I never knew my grandparents on his side of the family. But he was a really, really tough guy. Really tough guy. My mom was very subservient to my dad. She was always in a good mood, always happy. If my dad wanted to paint the walls in the living room white, they were white. I mean, it was just good for me to see leadership and how it was supposed to operate in the home. And my sister and I also had a good relationship growing up. For me, personally, one of the things that God blessed me with was the ability to play sports. And this was a really positive thing for me growing up. In the area where I grew up, there were tough guys. There were steel workers, iron workers, coal miners. But from the time I was 11 years old until I graduated from college, We had four newspapers in the area I lived in. We had the Weirton Daily Times, which Weirton was about 30,000 people at the time. We had the Steubenville Herald Star that was right across the river, 4 miles away. That was about 40,000 people. The Wheeling Intelligencer, which was about 30 miles away, that was about 50,000 people. And then we had the Pittsburgh Press and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And because of the success I had as an athlete, the smaller three papers, my name was in those papers a lot for basketball and baseball. When I was 11, I was the first little leaguer in the history of Weirton to hit three home runs over the fence in one game. The next year, we were in the American League in Little League. When I was 12, we had the National League. We were 15-0. This other team had a 35-game winning streak. You know, and it's like leading up in the, this is small town America. You know, they're doing feature articles on us. It was just something that was a very positive experience for me. And that game where they had a 35-game winning streak, I pitched a perfect no-hit game. We won that game. We lost the next game. And then I came back and pitched the third game, which was a championship game. And we lost 1-0, and I pitched a two-hitter. But throughout my whole childhood, you know, I was kind of a big fish in a small pond, if you will. And I say that with all humbleness. I mean, I had no idea. You know, this was just the way my life was. I knew a lot of people. At that time, my mom was clearly my biggest fan. I remember my mom and dad, they would show up at every game. I mean, I remember when I was 12 or 13 years old playing in a game, and I just remember sitting on the bench thinking, I mean, are they going to show up for every game? You know, because other parents didn't always show up, but they showed up. And even, you know, I'm a senior in college, you know, and I'm pitching in college, and you know, I would call my mom from the dorm room and say, hey, I'm pitching the first game of a doubleheader in Charleston, West Virginia on a Wednesday. And you know, I look up in the stands at 1 o'clock and they were in the stands. So I had a lot of support. I had what I thought was really a normal childhood. I was punished when I deserved to be punished. I remember when I was about 12 years old, the Wheeling Intelligencer was a morning paper, and so I wanted to make some money, so I got this paper out like about a month and a half before school ended. And it was pretty cool during school because I had to get up early, but then in the summertime, it wasn't so cool, you know, because I got to get up at 5 o'clock. And so the papers would come in the morning, and there might be 40 papers wrapped up in a string. And we lived about 50 yards from woods that, if you walk down these woods, down these hills, it would take you to the Ohio River. Well, I didn't want to deliver these papers one morning, so I just take these papers and I walk over and toss them in the woods, come back in, say, Mom, papers didn't show up. So I go back to bed. Well, I did this 3 or 4 times. Well, my dad's a cop. So one night he says, you know what, we had another, his name, they called him Mitch, and he had another cop friend that lived in the neighborhood named Mitchie. And him and Mitchie stayed up all night in our living room. And I knew they were doing this, that they were going to see who was stealing these papers. So of course the papers showed up that morning and I delivered the papers. Well, I guess it was maybe a week later. I remember we had to go to Washington, PA, which was about a 40-minute ride. We had a basement in our house and they were going to turn it into a rec room. So they were going to go look at paneling. So my sister and I were sitting in the back seat. I was in the right side. I remember this like it happened yesterday. My dad's a tough dude, you know, and real calm, but we're driving, and about 10 minutes after we left, he kind of goes, hey, Craig, how long you been throwing those papers in the woods? You know, and I'm sitting in the back seat, and I'm like, well, you know, I started stuttering, and he just says, you're gonna get an ass whipping when we get home. And just the way he did this, because, I mean, I had to drive 40 miles to Washington, PA. Then I had to go into the paneling store and sit in a paneling store. I don't even know how long we were in there. Then we had to drive all the way back. And he did. He took me into my bedroom, and I remember him saying, this is going to hurt me more than it hurt you. And he had me pull down my pants, and he ripped me pretty good, you know. But I deserved it. But it was a good perspective learning experience for me. So as I look back on my childhood, it was really a good childhood, and I was punished when I deserved to be punished. I was never physically, emotionally, spiritually, sexually abused. I mean, I just thought it was normal. And I was probably a little bit tougher for my sister. She was the rebel of the family. And unfortunately for her, because of the success I had in sports, our vacations were going to the state Little League championship, the Babe Ruth state championship, you know, so everything was focused on me. So as I look back, I can see why she rebelled. You know, it's easy to sit back and to look at the instant replay. You know, when I was going through all this stuff, I didn't really exactly know, you know, what was happening. But as I look back, you know, I can see why she was frustrated by, you know, the attention that I got. And she was a good athlete, and, you know, she was a good student. She had a lot of good things going on with her, but she was the rebellious one. I also had my aunt and uncle. My uncle worked in a steel mill, and he retired when he was 50. My uncle Alex and Aunt Julia, so they lived catty corner to us. So they were always coming to the games that I played in, you know, all the way through high school and college. So I had a really good support system. Now, as far as the spiritual side, we grew up in a denominational church, and I went to a denominational grade school and a denominational high school. So this was really just part of our life. I remember as a little kid, I don't know where I learned this, but I remember I might have been 10 or 11 years old, laying in my backyard and laying underneath a tree, which I know you can't do here in Texas, but we could do that in West Virginia, and just looking up, and it was a nice day, and the clouds were going by, and somewhere along the line, as a kid, I had learned that God always was and always will be. And I just remember as a kid, just I don't even know why I thought that, but I remember clearly, you know, thinking about that, trying to comprehend that, and I still really can't even comprehend it today. But so I did have this sense of who God was, and then I remember something else had happened to me. When I was in high school, we had some friends that had a big house and a big yard and a pool, and around the pool they had statues, like a half a statue sitting on a, you know, yeah. And so I remember having this dream that I was at this party with all these friends of mine that I know, and I walked past this statue, and it was a statue of the head of Jesus Christ. And as I walked by this statue, the statue looked at me, and I just remember just waking up in the middle of the night because it was like the statue became real and just looked me right in the face. And so I remember that too. So I had some sense of some spirituality, but I was just, you know, I was a religious guy doing religious things as a kid. You know, we went to church every Sunday or Saturday, Saturday, Sunday, and that was just the way it was. There was no question we were going to do that. So going through growing up in as a kid and in high school, I would say a lot of things were pretty normal. And again, my perspective is based on what's going on in my family, the church I'm going to, and whatever beliefs I'm getting from what I'm learning at my church. So I remember something that happened that really kind of began to change my perspective. My senior year in high school, the second semester of our senior year, we had an elective class called News, and this class met twice a week for the whole semester, and there was maybe only 12 seniors in this class, but we studied, the whole class, we studied the Kennedy assassination. And, you know, Kennedy was murdered in 1963, so this is 1975. And I just remember going home, but we did it, you know, we didn't have computers or anything like that back then. We just had encyclopedias, Newsweek, Time Magazine, Life Magazine. We'd go to the library and see what we found, everything we could, and we just went through this assassination. And I remember just going home, and my dad's a cop, and saying, telling my mom and dad, I cannot believe that you believe the Warren Report. You know, the Warren Report was the official government report about the Kennedy assassination. So I remember that really kind of had an effect on me, you know, because from what we were looking at and what was being reported officially, it just didn't seem that it could be possible that one person can do what they claim they could do. So I just remember that being a part of something that really started to change my perspective. I didn't understand it at the time, but I just felt like there was something not right about it. So coming out of high school, I had a couple opportunities to play basketball and baseball in college. I was again, I say this with all humbleness, I was an all-state basketball player, an all-state baseball player in West Virginia. Of course, I have no clue about this. I mean, you know, I mean Weirton's the 30,000 people, and Weirton is the fifth largest city in the state, you know, just to give you an idea. This is just the way it is. But again, I don't know this at the time. You know, I know that I'm having success. And so I got a call from this school called James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia. It used to be an all-girls school that became a co-ed school. They had all new facilities, and the coach wanted me to go down and take a visit there. So my mom and dad and I went down. And I remember this coach telling us that he couldn't give me a scholarship my freshman year, but if I made the team, I mean, he would give me a scholarship. So my parents liked the school. You know, we certainly were, you know, an average family. We didn't have a lot of money. We always drove used cars. But I never felt like I wanted for anything. But this was out-of-state tuition, and my parents said, well, go there and make the team. So I go to school there. And what I didn't know is when I got there, this coach had told the same thing he told me and my parents to 15 or 20 other guys who were coming to school. So I was naive about this, you know, and I remember just trying to comprehend why a coach, you know, would say that, you know. So again, my perspective of things are starting to change, but I do make the team. I'm one of the three freshmen that make the team. But then when it came to the end of the year, you know, they said, well, you know, I can't give you a scholarship. So I transferred to a school near my hometown called West Liberty well, it's West Liberty University now, but it was a good baseball school. And again, as a kid, I mean, the only thing I ever really want to do is be a professional athlete. You know, I'm not thinking about being a fireman, a doctor, a lawyer, nothing. I just wanted to play sports. I love playing sports. So this is, you know, kind of in my mind what I want to do. So I transfer to this school, and I don't have to sit out because this was an NAIA school, and I had an offer or a chance to go there right out of high school. So now I'm on this team, and I end up my senior year. I become the captain of the team. I'm first team all conference. I don't get drafted though by any major league team. I try out for the Pirates and the Dodgers and the Reds. But the book on me is that I don't throw hard enough to be a pitcher, and I don't run fast enough to be a hitter. So I'm a pitcher and a DH, a designated hitter in college. So, you know, I got to try to figure out what I'm going to do now with my life. But another thing that really affected me, in the summertime, when I was in college, between my junior and senior year, and then after my senior year, before I moved here, the mill, Weirton Steel, would hire people to hire college students to work in the mill as summer employment. They called us probies. We were probational employees. Now this mill, I don't know if I said this, but this mill employs 15,000 people. 15,000 people. You drive down Weirton, and on either side of Main Street, Tom knows because he's from Pittsburgh, and well, Jordan knows because he's been there. It's just a mill for a mile and a half, 2 miles maybe. I mean, either side of Main Street is this mill, because there's 15,000 people working there, and it was owned by National Steel. So I get a job there in the summertime, and I mean, it's fantastic money. And I'm on a labor gang, and this labor gang are college students. There were eight of us, six men. But this is the first summer, I'm thinking this is 1978, where equal opportunity starts to make a play in America. So we have two girls, they're on this labor gang with us. For the first time ever, these girls are working in the mill. So one of the girls was an okay worker, but this other girl, she was maybe 5'2", but she was a great worker, man. She did everything great. And we did jobs like sweep, you know, dig ditches, cut grass, mop, whatever they needed us to do. Well, one day we walk into work and we're already, you know, we have steel tip shoes on, jeans, a shirt, hard hat, and safety glasses. And our foreman, he starts flipping out these cloth overalls. So, you know, I'm thinking, well, this probably isn't going to be good because we've painted before and we never put on cloth overalls. So I put on this big cloth overhaul thing, and then he tosses out plastic overalls to put over the top of the cloth overhauls. Then they give us boots that we put on that come up to our knees. And then they gave us these gloves. They were steel lace gloves. In the fingertips, there were pieces of steel that, you know, and the gloves came up to here. They were real, not leather, but I don't know what they were, but they were really thick. So what we had to do, the mill, one of the parts of the mill, one of the machines would shut down, and it was cutting steel. So on the floor of the mill, there was this hatch that they opened up, and there was a ladder that went down about 8 feet. And so we split up. You know, there were two hatches, one on one side and one on the other side. So my partner was a guy, and they put one of the girls with each one of the foursomes. They split us up into foursomes. So the other guy had a partner as a girl. So they told us it was going to be about 115 degrees when we got down into this pit. It was about 6 inches of grease, and there was steel, pieces of steel that were maybe 8 inches to 20 inches in a bucket about this big with the rope on it. So I went down first. You know, I go down and I fill up, I'm filling this stuff. I mean, grease is splashing all over all of us. It's going through everything. So I fill up the bucket, and they said, just stay down there about 10 minutes and take turns. So I went down for the first 10 minutes. My partner pulls up the bucket, tosses it away. Then we switched. He went down. I pulled it up, and then we took a break. Well, now the girl goes down. This hardworking girl, she goes down, and she fills up the bucket. Well, when they switch, she can't pull up the bucket, you know? And so me and my buddy we're helping her. You know, we don't think anything about it, but I just remember thinking, well, how is this fair? I mean, we're both making the same amount of money, but she's working a job that she doesn't have the physical skills to do. So that had an impact on my perspective. And what I began, as I look back, I realized, well, this was big business. You know, this is a national corporation. And so I don't understand this. You know, I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And then later that summer, we just had whatever we did that particular day, I had a screwdriver. And I remember it was a hot day. So we went into a crane operator's booth, which was maybe 15 by 15, but it was air conditioned. So we just sat on the floor, we ate our lunch, but there's a light switch, and the cover of the light switch was laying on the floor, and there was a screw next to it. So I ate my lunch, and I got up, and I walked over, and I picked up the cover, and my foreman says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm going to screw this cover back on." And he goes, "You can't do that." Well, you know, I thought he was kidding, you know, because I had to do everything else he told me to do. So I laughed, and I continued. He goes, "Craig, you can't do that." And I go, "What do you mean I can't do that?" He said, "That's a job for an electrician." So I said, so, you know, we didn't have phones or anything back then. So I said, "You're telling me that somebody has to write a work order?" He goes, "Yeah, we're a union shop." So I'm just imagining some electrician, you know, a mile and a half away getting a work order that he has to go and put this light switch back on. You know, I wasn't allowed to do it because I wasn't an electrician. So this was a learning experience to me. So I'm not understanding this. You know, I'm still a young man. I'm 19 or 20 years old. But again, my perspectives are starting to change because, you know, I'm expanding. I'm starting to grow. So I graduate from college. And so now what am I going to do? Well, one of the great things about being in college was during spring break, we had snow on the ground a lot of times in West Virginia. So we would always go to Florida and play teams in Florida. So just imagine two vans, 12 guys in each van, and we're driving to Florida. And we traveled everywhere by van. So this is some of the great memories of my life, right? I'm with these guys in these vans, the things we did. I remember one time, and what would happen was, the coach, he didn't have an assistant. He would drive one of the vans, and one of the players would drive the other vans. Well, this was my junior year. We had just lost the regional playoffs out in Fairfax, Virginia. So after we went to D.C. and looked at D.C., and we stopped at this restaurant. So 24 guys go into this restaurant. Well, our coach gave the money to Tommy Luft, our shortstop, to pay the bill, you know. So we all load up in the vans, and Tommy T. Luft, the last one running to the van. And so we're cruising out of D.C., and we're about 15 minutes away from the restaurant, and all of a sudden, man, sirens, flashing lights. Well, T. Luft decided to walk the bill, you know. So just the kind of stuff that, you know, the thing I look back, I realize how much I love being around guys, you know, heterosexually. I really like being around guys. So anyhow, another, you know, so now, I always wanted to move to California. And the reason that started was because I remember as a kid watching the late NFL game. You know, and it might be November, December, it's cold. It's already nighttime in West Virginia. But, you know, the LA Rams or the Chargers would be on. And back then, the TVs, you know, color TV, I think, didn't even start until sometime in the 60s, right? And I remember, like, the Charger game would be on, and it would be so bright and sunny that the camera had a hard time, you remember, it had a hard time kind of focusing in because it was so bright on the field. And everyone was in visors and short-sleeved shirts. So I thought, man, I'm gonna move to California. But when I graduated from college, we started reading about Houston. You know, Houston is the land of milk and honey. It was 1979. Things are booming. And I don't know why or how my dad knew this, but he always encouraged me and my sister that if we really wanted to make anything out of our lives, we had to move out of Weirton. And somehow he knew that the steel industry was going to go down. And he was really prophetic about that. I mean, after the things I experienced, you know, with the I understand why, but so I had a friend of mine named Bill Harper. We called him Harp. I was Eggs. That was my nickname. My dad's nickname was Eggs. We all had nicknames. So I was Eggs. He was Harp, and he played basketball at Duquesne University. And we just decided to go to Houston. You know, I had been to Tampa a couple times, and we looked on a map because that's what we had to do back then. And you know, Galveston was only 50 miles from Houston, and we were like, man, you know, and Glenn Campbell had that song, Galveston, oh Galveston, so man, we would always say, because he had been to Tampa too, he had relatives there, and of course, the Gulf of Mexico in Tampa was just a little bit different than the Gulf of Mexico in Galveston, but anyhow, we took off. I didn't even have a car. He had a car, because his dad had passed away a few years earlier when he was in high school, and two things I remember about the day we left. Earlier that day, I drove up to his house and we loaded up his car. If you just can imagine, well, we didn't have anything. We didn't have a U-Haul. We just had what we can get in his car. And I went back home and I remember my dad telling me, he said, Craig, because he knew I majored in business. He said, Craig, he said, you know, I have a lot of friends that are cops. And he said, some of my friends that are cops, he said, something changes when they put on the gun and the badge. He goes, they're really good guys, but he said, when they put on the gun and the badge, you know, they have this power and something changes. And he goes, you're gonna deal with that in the business world. You know, I didn't know what he was talking about, but I remember him telling me that. So anyhow, so my mom and dad and sister, they take me up to Harp's house. We're gonna drive all night. You know, we're 20 years old. We're gonna drive all night. So Harp's mom and his two sisters and brother were there, and everybody was crying. Because we were leaving, Harp was crying. Everybody was crying except me and my dad. You know, my dad just shook my hand and hugged me, and his parting words were, "Craig, at least I spend my money on somebody I know." That's what he told me. So I thought that was pretty funny, but that's what he said when we left. So we take off, and so now I'm coming into the big city. So we move. I had a friend of mine that I played baseball with. He graduated a year earlier than me, and so he comes here a year before me. Me and Harp stay with him. We get an apartment. So we're moving into the apartment. That took about 30 minutes, and this guy sees us, and his name's Shoes. He comes walking up, and he goes, "Hey, you guys play softball?" You know, and we're in Houston for 3 days. You know, yeah, we play softball. He goes, "Well, we got a team. We got practice tonight." So that night, we knew 12 people, right? You know, right out of the chute. So they saw that we didn't have anything. So one of the guys had a mattress and a box springs. We didn't have any furniture. So we took the mattress and laid it next to the box springs, and we slept the top half of our bodies on the mattress and the bottom parts of our bodies on the box springs. That's what we did. I mean, it was just nuts. I mean, it was. And it was an adventure, you know, and we gathered stuff, and I was living a pretty normal life, you know. I was never much of a drinker. I could say probably my whole life, I honestly think I might have been drunk maybe 4 or 5 times in my whole life, if that. I like to smoke weed. I like smoking weed because, you know, I could take 2 hits off of a joint and wake up the next morning and feel fine. So I like, that's kind of what I did. So I was living a good life and enjoying my life, and then one day I met a woman, You know, now I've met a lot of women, but I've met this woman I really liked. Her name was Angela. She worked in a bank, and she had a child. She had gotten pregnant when she was in college. She went to a college in Utah that was a religious college, and so she had gotten pregnant. She had to leave college because she got pregnant. And so I started seeing her, but I was honest with her, you know, because when I came here, I should tell you that before I met Angela, I was working for this company that was based out of St. Louis, and I was always talking to the sales guy in St. Louis, and he was a single guy, and we both had never been to California, so we both flew to Dallas, and we flew to California together just to go to California, you know. And I remember we landed in San Diego at night, and the next morning, we stayed on the bay. I don't remember where. It's San Diego, but it was night when we landed. So the next morning, when I got up and walked outside, I remember John Denver had a song, and one of the lyrics was that I had come home to a place that I had never been before, and that's the way I felt when I was in San Diego. So my goal became, all right, I'm going to get some experience, and I'm going to move to California. So when I started seeing Angela, I liked her and enjoyed being with her, but I would say, look, if you're looking to get married, because she had a kid, I said, I'm not your guy, you know, because I'm going to California. I want to move to California. And she said, hey, you know, don't worry about it. I understand. I'm not looking to get married. So we saw each other off and on for about a year, and then I got an interview to go to California. This company in Houston was looking for someone out there. I remember telling her I was going to go interview out there, and she was pretty frustrated about that, which I was kind of surprised because I, you know, I was being honest with her and saying, what's so funny? And she was surprised? Yeah, why not? Well, I didn't know. I mean, hey, I'm a young guy, man. I'm, you know, naive. So anyhow, I don't get the job, but about 3 weeks after that, I'm with her one day, and she says to me the two words that most single men don't want to hear: I'm pregnant. Well, I mean, I'm angry, I'm embarrassed. I mean, I didn't tell my parents for 6 months because I was so embarrassed that I got her pregnant. I'm mad, I'm angry, I'm blaming her because she's already got pregnant once, and now she's pregnant, and now this time it's my kid. And so in the office I worked in, there was this guy named Wayne Pickle, who I now know was a Christian guy, but I guess he saw that I was down, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, why is this happening to me? Because, I mean, I spend time with women, but I honestly don't ever remember having a one-night stand in my life where I walked into a bar, grabbed a woman, and went home with her. I don't ever remember doing that. I would date women, enjoyed being with them, and I was sleeping with them. I didn't know any better. I was sleeping with them. So he gives me this book called The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey. So I didn't know anything about this. So for those of you who don't know, Hal Lindsey is a quote-unquote biblical scholar, but he wrote this book about the book of Revelation, which is the final book of the Bible, and there's just a lot of different language in there that's difficult. But he said, you need to read this book, and I was searching for anything. So I read this book. This book is written in 1970. This is 1984 that I read this book. And of course, it's about biblical prophecy, which I know nothing about. But I remember finishing this book and realizing that I learned more about Jesus Christ by reading one book than I did the first 26 or 27 years of my life going to grade school, high school, and church every week. So I immediately quit going to the church that I was going to, and I did what most guys do. I began searching. So I went to Lakewood Church, where John was. Yeah, that's right, John Osteen, who was Joel's dad. He was the pastor. So I go to Lakewood Church. This is on the east side of town. I mean, there's people speaking in tongues. I mean, you know, music playing. I went to Second Baptist to listen to Ed Young. I went to First Baptist to listen to John Bassanio. So I'm starting to hear this message that I've never really heard before. And I really don't know what to do with Angela. So Angela has our first daughter. Her name's Brenna. Well, now I'm looking at Brenna, and you know, I realize I'm not moving to California. You know, I'm thinking about how I was raised, and you know, my parents sitting in the stands, you know, when I was 21 years old, rooting for me. So Angela moves back in with her dad, and so now she's got two kids out of wedlock, and one of them are mine. And so I go visit Brenna. I'm still mad at Angela. And I started to feel guilty, you know, and I was watching this movie called Shenandoah. I don't know if you guys remember that movie with Jimmy Stewart. It was a Civil War movie. Jimmy Stewart's like a patriarch of this family. And his wife's name was Martha. She was already dead during the movie, but the grave was on, you know, this big property that he had, and he was always going to the grave and talking to her. And I remember him saying something to the effect of, you know, well, Martha, well, hell, I learned to love you, you know. And I thought, well, man, you know, I'm going to try to learn to love Angela, you know. So I said, let's try to do this again. So we went out a couple times. I slept with her again. And then she said those two magic words to me again: I'm pregnant. So is anybody here familiar with, Rick Shelton probably is, Proverbs 26:11? As a dog returns to his vomit, so a fool returns to his folly. So that was me. So I have to call my mom and dad again, and all my friends, tell them that I got Angela pregnant again. Well, about 6 months before all this, my mom called me one day and she said, Craig, I've accepted Christ and have become a Christian. And I'm starting to hear all this stuff about being a Christian now. So she told me, and she told me she left the church and she was going to this other church and she was slain in the spirit. I don't know what any of this means. I just know she tells me she's a Christian. So she had already accepted Christ. And so I got this child coming, another child. And then I met this girl named Cindy, not my wife, but I met this, she was a complex, we called them complex girls, you know, in our apartment complex. Like if a girl lived in the apartment, she was a complex girl. It was original. So I meet this, and I really like this girl. So I mean, I got this baby coming, another baby coming, and she knows my story. I'm honest with her, but I mean, I really like this girl, and I'm not sleeping with her. You know, we're fooling around, but I'm like, man, I'm scared to death to do anything at this stage of the game. And so, yeah, it's funny now. So I'm seeing Cindy, and I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do with Angela. Angela has my second daughter, whose name is Rebecca. So now I got two kids. She has a kid, three kids. And I'm messing around with Cindy, and I don't know what I'm going to do. And I come home from work one day, and I pull up to my apartment, and man, I'm thinking, that's Cindy's car, and that's Angela's car that's parked in front of my apartment. So I just kept driving. I didn't even stop, man. I just kept driving. But I knew eventually I was going to have to go back, and I went back, and I got drilled by both of them. And I think it must have been a night or two later. My mom, I don't know how she sensed this or whatever, she called me, and I was in my apartment. And she called me, and she said, Craig, do you want to accept Jesus Christ as your Savior? And man, I was nowhere, you know. And I said, Mom, I do, you know. So she goes, well, say this prayer. And I said something to the effect of, well, Lord, I'm a sinner. I believe that, you know, you became a man. You came to the earth. You lived a perfect life. You went to the cross and died for me. You know, you died for me. I'm a sinner. You died for me. You were crucified. You were buried. You rose on the third day. You ascended into heaven, and you sent your Holy Spirit back to be with us. And so my mom, I said that, and my mom says, well, Craig, you're a Christian now. So I remember hanging up the phone, and I was in this one-bedroom apartment, and I remember looking around, and this is really the first verse that came to my mind, John 3:16. Who can tell me what John 3:16 is? Rick Shelton. That's right. So I remember that's the first time a verse really came. And you know why I remember that verse? You remember the dude with the big rainbow hair? I mean, he was always behind home plate, you know. And I that's the first verse. And I remembered that verse only because I saw it so many times on TV. And I remember sitting in my apartment thinking that when I die, I'm going to have eternal life. And I remember thinking, this is pretty cool. And so I felt like at that time the right thing to do was to marry Angela. We got married. I went to her and said, look, you know, I was going to try to learn how to love her, you know. And I want to be clear. I mean, Angela, she's a good person. She's a really good person. It's just that, I mean, how many women in your life have you met that you say, I'm going to marry that woman? You know, there was nothing wrong with her. It's just, we just weren't on the same page, you know. I say it's up, she said it's down. I said it's black, she said it's white. Just probably like most people. But I married her. We got married in Herman Park, and I remember as soon as we were married, we were walking, and I remember my mom was crying, and I don't think they were tears of joy, but Angela grabbed my butt, and she said, your ass belongs to me now. So I remember that. I'm not sure what to think about that, but she was right, you know. So we got married, and so now all of a sudden, I've gone from a single guy. We rented a house. Now I'm married. We got three kids, and so I'm a new Christian, and I'm trying to figure out what to do because Angela she's going to this school in Utah, and she got excommunicated from her church when she got pregnant. So she's not really part of a church at this point in time, and I want her. You know, I'm a new Christian, and so I start going to this church called Cypress Bible Church on the northwest side of town where we're living. And they had a pastor named Johnny Miller, who was a great pastor. I really enjoyed listening to him. And so that's really kind of how the first part of my life. So now I'm married, and I have no clue, you know, what I'm doing. And I guess I'll just leave it there because it's 8:25 already. So that's really just to give you an idea of how my perspective, you know, the first 30 years of my life, these are the things that are shaping my perspective. And so, you know, tomorrow I'll have a handout, and I have some of the Bible verses that I've come across over the years and the things that happened once I got married to Angela and once I got involved with discipleship. So, well, Lord, thanks for this time tonight. Thanks for these men, and I just look forward for the next 20 hours or so. So we just thank you and praise you in Jesus' name. Amen.